Well, hello and good Friday morning. It is Friday, June 5th, and we are continuing to go through the Bible and look at material that we passed over as we were going through the text the first time around as we were preaching through. And we've been going through David's wilderness wanderings in 1 Samuel and now into 2 Samuel as we anticipate David finally being crowned king over the entire nation. Now, what I've said is, in these wilderness wanderings areas, we have kind of a scene change back and forth from David to the Saulite dynasty, whether that be Saul or Jonathan, or we have the armies of Ish-bosheth, who would be the son of Saul, and led by Abner, son of Ner, and we keep having these scene changes back and forth where we're looking at it, and we see kind of this power struggle idea, but what we see is that David is on the ascendancy, and the Saulite dynasty is descending. It's on the descendancy. And so this morning, we're going to look at chapter 2, and actually even getting into a little bit of chapter 3. So what we have this morning is, if you read chapter 2, verses 1 through, well, all of it, 33, and then read chapter 3, verses 1 through 5, you will see that there is, that's quite a bit of material, but we're going to go through it, even though this is, according to the Net Bible, this is two separate pericopes, and it probably should be, but for sake of time, we're going to cover both of them this morning. So go ahead and pause your audio, listen, read chapter 2, verses 1 through the whole thing, and then the first 5 verses of chapter 3. Okay, so we look here, and really what is important is to look at our 5 W's as we go through this text. Since you've already read it, we know who we're looking at, but you know, who is involved? Well, we have David, we have the men of David, we have the people of Jabesh-Gilead, we have the people of Judah, we have Abner, son of Ner, we have Ish-bosheth, we have different people are mentioned, different people in different areas of Israel. You can read about those in verse 9. But really, as we go through, the important characters are really David and Abner, son of Ner. Those are the most important characters for a while, but then there are people who also show up who are very important. And so if you look in verse 18, you see that the sons of Zeruiah, or Zeruiah, as people sometimes say, Joab, Abishai, and Asahel, those are David's nephew slash cousins, depending on how you want to look at that. And they come into the story, and their entrance into the story is critical here. Now, we already know a little bit about Abishai, because Abishai had gone with David when he had when he sneaked into the camp of Saul and he stole Saul's spear and his water jug, and Abishai was willing to kill him. So we already know about Abishai. We know that he is brave. We know that he's fearless. We also know that he is willing to kill a king. Okay, Abishai is not a fearful person, but we also see the introduction of Joab, and we haven't really seen Joab yet, but Joab is kind of the leader of the three brothers. And so he's introduced into the story, and Abner, son of Ner, of course, becomes really, really popular and really powerful, or at least he is already. So that's our who. Where is this story happening? Well, this story is kind of taking place in a series of areas, and we see that the major action happens in the place called the Field of Flints, and I think that the NIV does not translate that. I think that they just make that they just transliterate it, so it's Helkath Hazarim. I'm pretty sure that's what the NIV does with it, but the Field of Flints is, or the Field of Daggers is also what it could be translated as. So that's where this happens. And when does this happen? Well, this happens after David has been anointed king of Judah. So that's the important material in chapter 2, verses 1 through 7, is that after Saul has died, after Jonathan has died, after everybody who was important has died, David is crowned the king of Judah. Now remember, David has been bringing plunder to the people of Judah. David is a Judean. David has actually been anointed king by Saul, or by Samuel. So there's every reason that David should be king, but when you create dynasties, you know, people who have an interest in remaining in power probably want to remain in power. Judah was one of the, geographically, the biggest tribes, and numerically it was a very big tribe. And there were a lot of people who probably sided with Ish-bosheth simply because they wanted to curtail the power of the tribe of Judah. Now, that's me speculating. I can't say that for certain, but I would say that that's probably a pretty good reason why a lot of people wanted to side with Ish-bosheth. You know, for a long time, Ephraim seemed to be the strongest tribe. But then eventually Benjamin was chosen, and Benjamin was the smallest of the tribes. But at this point in history, it seems like Judah is already really strong and really large, and people are worried about if Judah becomes the royal tribe, then, you know, is that just going to allow Judah to kind of overwhelm the other tribes? Is that going to make Judah too strong? So I can't prove that, but that's my speculation, at least for why a lot of people sided with Ish-bosheth and the family of Saul. It could simply also be that you know, people think that, you know, okay, well, maybe David was anointed king, but, you know, we still have loyalty to Ish-bosheth because he's the son of the anointed king, because that's how kingdoms work, you know. So it's very confusing. It's very hard to understand. But that's when this is happening. So what happens? Well, as we already said, we see that David was anointed the king. Okay, so David goes up to Hebron after he inquires of the Lord. He inquires of Yahweh. So Abiathar was obviously the one who inquired of the Lord for David because he was with him after his father Ahimelech was killed. And so he goes, and the Lord says, go to Hebron, and he takes his wives with him. Again, we have his two wives are named. Notice he has a third wife. His third wife's name is Michal, the daughter of Saul. But he has two wives who are with him, Ahinoam, the Jezreelite, and Abigail, formerly the wife of Nabal the Carmelite. And David brought them along with the men who were with him, each with his family. They settled in Hebron. And David was told the people of Jabesh-Gilead are the ones who buried Saul. So David sent messengers to these people and said, you know, may God bless you because of your kindness. And, you know, may the Lord show you true kindness, and I will reward you because you have done this deed. Now be courageous and prove to be valiant warriors, for your lord Saul is dead, and the people of Judah have anointed me king over them. And so David goes, and he thanks these people. He's like, hey, you did a great thing by going and valiantly, bravely going into Philistine territory and getting the bodies of Saul and his men back and burying them. You guys are brave. Now keep being brave, because I'm the king now. And again, we see David has a lot of tact. Okay, now you can say, is this disingenuous? Well, no, you can be tactful and genuine at the same time. I think that's maybe a harder line to walk. But I think David combines tact with earnestness. Because again, those things aren't mutually exclusive. I think a lot of times we think they are, but they're not. And so, of course, we continue into verse 8 and following, and we look into this second section, and we see, well, what happens? Okay, so Abner, the son of Ner, is the commander, and he appoints Ish-bosheth the king over basically the northern tribes, and Ish-bosheth rules for 2 years. However, the Judeans, they follow David, and David was king in Hebron for 7.5 years. That's what we read in verse 11. And of course, okay, so we find out, we already know the end from the beginning. David is king in Hebron for 7.5 years, but Ish-bosheth only reigns for 2 years. So for 5.5 years, David remains in Hebron and doesn't go to Jerusalem, even after he defeats Ish-bosheth and becomes the king of the entire land. Okay, so that number does not mean that for 5.5 years there was chaos, or that David was anointed king over Judea 5.5 years before Ish-bosheth was crowned. It's talking about David was in Hebron for 7.5 years, but David was king for 5.5 of those years over the entire area. Okay, so Abner, son of Ner, and the servants of Ish-bosheth, son of Saul, so we know what this relationship is, they go to Gibeon, and Joab, the son of Zeruiah, they also go out, and they confront them at the pool of Gibeon. And they're on either side of the pool, and Abner says to Joab, you know, let the soldiers get up and fight before us. And Joab says, okay. So it seems as though they're trying to have some kind of single combat. But it was a group, like kind of group single combat. As we'll see, they pick numbers. They have 12 of them from Benjamin and 12 of them from the servants of David. And the idea was, you know, they weren't going to send the entire group together into battle, because that could be needlessly destructive. So they were going to determine who was going to hold this area based upon a small representative combat. So it's not really single combat, but it's representative combat. And so they each send 12 men over, and And then verse 16, this is the fascinating thing. They grappled with each other. So they're wrestling with each other, and all of them stabbed his opponent with their sword, and all of them fall dead together. So 24 guys go out, and I mean, they're fighting, and nobody is able to completely conquer his opponent, and all of them die. And then of course, verse 17 says, now the battle was very severe that day. Well, why was the battle severe that day? Well, because this was supposed to be representative combat, which would not allow all the soldiers to fight. This is part of what happened in the ancient world, and we often forget about this, is that when you have two fairly evenly matched opponents, or two opponents that feel that they're evenly matched, rather than risk the lives of your entire army, you're going to send representatives out to fight. You're going to send each of your armies is going to send 12 men out, and whoever wins, they take the field. And then you don't have to have a huge battle. You don't risk total loss, which is, of course, what you risk every time you go into battle. You risk total loss. And it says that Abner and the men of Israel were overcome by David's soldiers. The three sons of Zeruiah were there, Joab, Abishai, and Azahel. And it says, now Azahel was quick on his feet as one of the gazelles in the field, and Azahel chased Abner without turning to the right or the left as he followed Abner. Now, why is Asahel following Abner? Because Abner is the power in Ishbosheth's reign. You read the text, read the biblical text, and you will see that Ishbosheth is one of the great chumps of history. Okay, you're probably tired of hearing me say it, but he is. He is a patsy. He is a puppet. Abner, the son of Ner, is the real power in that kingdom. He is a capable man. He is very intelligent. He is very powerful. He is a good warrior. He is a leader of men. Abner is everything that Ishbosheth was not. Okay? And so Azahel realizes that if he kills Abner, this war is pretty much over. And so he will not turn away. Now, apparently, because they were all in the army together beforehand, Abner knew Azahel. They were friends. They were friendly to each other. And Abner turned. So they're running, and he's chasing. So Abner turns around, and he looks at him. He says, is that you, Asahel? And Asahel says, yeah, it's me. And Abner said, turn to the right or the left. Go kill one of the soldiers and take his equipment for yourself. But Asahel was not willing to turn aside from following him. So basically what Abner is saying is, stop following me. Leave me alone. I know you're a capable warrior. Go kill one of my young men. Go kill one of my other soldiers. Don't follow me. Leave me alone. But Asahel would not do it. He would not turn around from following him. So Abner speaks again to him. He says, stop following me. I do not want to kill you. How then could I show my face in the presence of your brother Joab? Okay, so why is Abner holding back his hand? Because he and Joab had a friendly relationship. They were friends before this. And he says, Asahel, if I kill you, how will I ever be able to face your brother again? I can't do this. Go fight somebody else. Leave me alone. But Azahel refused to turn aside. So Abner struck him in the abdomen with the back end of his spear. The spear came out of his back. Azahel collapsed on the spot and died right there before Abner. Everyone who came to the place where Azahel fell dead paused in respect. Now, I'm not totally sure that I agree with that translation of paused in respect. I think that, you know, and they stood. Is how the NET puts it, and I think that maybe what that represents is maybe a realization that the war has become very personal and very bitter. That when you saw Azahel dead and you knew the relationship between the sons of Zeruiah, you knew that this war was not going to end peacefully. I think that's what's happening, is they realize with the death of Azahel that something very significant had happened. Now, Abner did what he did. I mean, he tried twice to save the guy's life. And when it says he got him with the back of the spear, you know, the backs of spears would have spikes on them. The butt ends of spears would have spikes. And so Azahel keeps chasing him. And Abner's, you know, older. He's not going to be able to outrun this guy forever. And so what does he do? You know, he just sends the spear backwards and puts it right through Azahel. You know, as Azahel's chasing him, he probably, or maybe he just, you know, he had the spear ready and he tucked it under his arm, and then he just like stopped all of a sudden, and it went through Azahel. But like I said, I think that what we see is people realize that with the death of Azahel, something very bad has happened, and so Joab and Abishai, they're chasing Abner and the men, and this battle has raged the entire day, and they get there, and the Benjamites formed ranks behind Abner and were like a single army standing on top of a hill. So they form this defensive position. And Abner calls out to Joab. He says, must the sword devour forever? Don't you realize this will turn bitter in the end? When will you tell the people to turn aside from pursuing their brothers? And Joab replied, as surely as God lives, if you have not said this, It would have been morning before the people would have abandoned the pursuit of their brothers. Again, that right there, verse 27, is really hard to translate. There are a lot of different translations, and it's hard to tell exactly what's being said. The net goes this way, but you know, the question is Joab being sincere? Is he being sarcastic? You can read some different translations, and you can draw your own conclusions. But they stop the pursuit. So Joab blows the horn, and all the people stopped in their tracks. They stopped chasing Israel, and they ceased fighting. And Abner and his men went through the Rift Valley all that night, and they crossed the Jordan River, and they went through the whole region of Bitron and came to Mahanaim. Now Joab, verse 30, so Joab is returning, and he assembles his people, and 19 of David's soldiers were missing, in addition to Asahel. Okay, so they lost 20 people. 12 of them were those who died in the field of daggers. Okay, so they lost an additional 8 men in this day-long battle. So that's not good. You don't want to lose 20 soldiers. But David's soldiers had slaughtered the Benjamites and Abner's men, and all 360 had died. So this was not a small contingent of soldiers that had died. I mean, Abner probably had showed up with more than 1,000, maybe several thousand men. Probably the people of Judah did as well. Probably armies in the thousands. And this was a pretty bad battle. And they took Asahel's body and they buried him in his father's tomb in Bethlehem. And Joab and his men traveled and they reached Hebron by dawn. And then it says, and then we get kind of this summary statement here in chapter 3. And it says, the war was prolonged between the house of Saul and the house of David. David became steadily stronger while the house of Saul was becoming increasingly weaker. Which, of course, is what we've seen. This is the pattern that we've already seen with these back and forths between David and the Saulite dynasty. And then it talks about how there were sons who were born to David in Hebron. Okay, the first was Amnon, born to Ahinoam. The second was Kileab, born to Abigail, the widow of Nabal, the Carmelite. The third was Absalom, the son of Maacah, daughter of King Talmai of Geshur. The fourth was Adonijah, the son of Haggith. The fifth was Shephatiah, the son of Abital. The sixth was Ithream, born to David's wife Eglah. These sons were all born to David in Hebron. So David has a lot of sons, and he's having all of these sons born within, you know, he's got, what is it? He's got 6 sons born within Hebron, you know. So he's got, in 7.5 years, he has 6 sons. So he's, you know, he's doing okay for himself. And he's got several wives, and he's increasing his harem. And why do we have this? I mean, this seems like a really strange addition. Well, I think the reason we have this addition at the end of chapter 3 is again because what we have is we've got this back and forth between Saul and David, or the Saulite dynasty and David. We have this back and forth. And it's really interesting to if you wanted to go through and print off this material, print off the wilderness wanderings of David, and do a color coding of the people of Saul and the people of David, and how we have these back and forth, and how they kind of converge, and it becomes a more of a rapid back and forth as they are clashing into open battle. Well, what do we see? Well, we see that they've lost 360 men. And then we see that the war had continued. Saul's army, the house of Saul grew weaker, the house of David grew stronger. And then what do we have? We see David having 6 sons by Ahinoam, Abigail, Maacah, Haggith, Abital, Eglah. So he has 6 sons by 6 different wives. What is this telling us? Is that David is growing stronger. He is being blessed by God. He has sons. He has property. He has wives. Which, again, I'm not saying that God is saying that he was blessed by having all these extra wives. I think what it's saying is by the popular convention of that day, having a harem was a sign of strength. He had all of these wives. And what do we see? We see David is established. He is being established. He is having lots and lots of children. Okay, that's a sign that he's becoming established, is he's having lots and lots of kids and lots of sons. Okay, the preponderance of sons that he's having right now is telling us that David is being blessed by God. He is becoming stronger. Joab and his men are becoming weaker. And what do we see? Well, we see that David is finally becoming, David is finally coming into his own. He's finally achieving what had been promised by God through Samuel all those many years ago. And So the question is, why is this in the text? Why is this in here? Well, I think there are a couple reasons, and perhaps, I mean, maybe the cop-out answer, because it's easy, but I think a significant answer is because it represents that God keeps his promises no matter what happens. You know, David was just a shepherd boy, but Samuel said, you'll be a king because God said you'll be a king. And then he's just a young man. He's just a soldier in the flower of his youth. How can he fight this seasoned giant like Goliath? Won't that risk God's promise? Nope, because God made good on his promise. And we see David is pursued. He fights the battles of the Lord. He fights against the Philistines. Is God going to be able to keep his promise? Yes, he is. Saul, in his insane rage, tries to kill David. Is God going to be able to keep his promise? Yes, he is. He goes to Philistine country. Is God going to be able to keep his promise? Yes, he is. Excuse me. And now they're in the midst of civil war. Is God going to be able to keep his promise? Yes, he is. And David begins to become established. God will make good his word. That's the key here to understanding this text, is that God will make good his word. Well, I hope you appreciate that. I hope that that's meaningful to you. And I hope you'll join us next week as we continue to look through the ending of these wilderness wanderings. We look through the very kind of sad and sordid end, which will probably take us a little bit, probably at least all of next week to finish up. And then after that, we're still going to be moving fairly slow through 2 Samuel, because 2 Samuel is really important material. 1 and 2 Samuel are books of real great importance in the biblical text. And then once we get into the Kings, we'll probably start speeding up a little bit. But anyways, I hope you have enjoyed this Bible study, and I hope to join you again Monday. So thank you. God bless.